loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, a federal judge in the Southern District of New York this week lashed out at immigration and customs enforcement actions in a written opinion, ordering the temporary release of an immigrants' rights activist whom ICE scooped up and scheduled for deportation. Ravi Ragbir, the leader of the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York, was released so that, in the judge's words, he could say goodbye to his family. Next, an Israeli legal rights group is suing two New Zealanders who reportedly convinced the pop singer Lorde to cancel a performance in Israel. This is the first lawsuit filed under a controversial Israeli anti-boycott law. And for the first time in its history, an officer of the Israeli secret police agency, the Shin Bet, is facing a criminal investigation over allegations of torture. Then, Bahrain's top court sentenced two people to death and almost 60 more to lengthy prison sentences yesterday on charges of terrorism in a case that the Bahrainis say proves Iranian meddling in their country. The Bahraini prosecutor said the defendants smuggled explosives and weapons into the country after having undergone training in Iran. And then Cape Town, South Africa, is dangerously close to running out of water. Day zero, as it's being called, is expected in April, and frantic preparations are underway to prepare for this impending ecological crisis. And finally, Saudi Arabia has moved the remaining 56 princes it has been holding in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel on corruption charges to secure private palaces and, in some cases, to actual prisons. Other princes have secured their own release by turning over to the government more than $106 billion that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman says was made through corrupt practices. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to immigration. A federal judge in the Southern District of New York this week lashed out at immigration and customs enforcement actions in a written opinion, ordering the temporary release of an immigrant rights activist whom ICE had scooped up and scheduled for deportation. Ravi Ragbir, the leader of the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York, was released so that, in the judge's words, he could say goodbye to his family. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of the New Sanctuary Coalition, where Ravi Ragbir is executive director. Juan Carlos, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, no, thank you. It's an honor.
Let's talk about Ravi. Let's talk about who he is. I'm going to quote from a New York Magazine article that was recently published. It says, in 1991, Ragbir came to the U.S. on a visitor's visa. He never expected to come stateside, but he wanted to improve his education. In 1994, he became a lawful permanent resident. The next year, his daughter Deborah was born. In order to support his new family, he took on whatever job he could, from risk manager to financial planner to dabbling in real estate and notary work. In 1999, Ragbir was working for a now-defunct mortgage lender as a low-level telemarketer. While on the job, he was approached by a broker who submitted loan applications to him. He then passed them on to his company, believing the paperwork to be legitimate, but it wasn't. When the broker was arrested and later indicted for wire fraud and conspiracy, several employees involved in those applications were also charged, including Ragbir, who was convicted in 2000 and sentenced to 30 months in prison. In 2006, he was transferred to detention, where an immigration judge ordered that he be removed based on his conviction. But let's really talk about who Ravi Ragbir is. He has become one of the most important and one of the most prominent activists for immigrant rights and for social justice. And I'm looking at a list here compiled by the Transcend Network for Peace Development, and it lists Ravi as one of the 100 most important living peace and justice activists in America. Not even in America, actually. This is around the world, one of the 100 most important living peace and justice activists. And it's a person like Ravi who is being scooped up and thrown out of the country. What's your reaction to all of this? This has to have been just a terrible week for you and Ravi and his family and the entire organization.
John, I think, you know, Ravi set out with a community behind him, to really pave a way, not only for himself, but to push back, under this unlawful, immoral justice system that has been preying on not only on Rabi, but on thousands and thousands of families. And he's been quite successful in terms of pushing back and still at risk. I mean, one of the principles of our coalition is, to have those who have the urgency of their cases, the urgency of their lives on the line, so to speak, to really be the face, to be in the front lines. And Rabi has done that.
He's done that for many years, hasn't he?
Yes. Yes.
For many
and
years.
He has built a tremendous solidarity and network of support throughout, because he has been tirelessly speaking out, truth to power. He has not shy away. He's always complying with the law. But he is also a man of vision and a man of integrity. So he has been able to push back, with a community that he has built around him. He has been able to push back on that law that, sometimes it's lagging behind the justice that is needed for many of our people. We cannot equate justice with the law, because as we have seen, at some point slavery was.
That was the law. Justice and the law are not necessarily compatible, I think we've come to realize. And this is not specific to the Trump administration either. I note that there were 3 million deportations during the 8 years of the Obama administration. In the New York Times today, it says that deportation arrests have soared under Donald Trump. Last year, ICE agents made 143,470 arrests, which is up 25% from a year earlier. But even Barack Obama's numbers were records of deportation. I wanted to make a point too, Juan Carlos, about checking in. You mentioned that Ravi had checked in like he was supposed to once or twice a year with ICE. What that check-in is, for our listeners who don't know, is an undocumented person must go to ICE offices, and it's normally, it always has been in the past, been a perfunctory pro forma meeting where the person just says nothing has changed since the last time I was here. Well, in Ravi's case, nothing had changed. Nothing had changed since the year 2000. But because
That's
of this
right.
political climate that we find ourselves in, he was scooped up in the meeting. And not even permitted to go back outside to tell his wife that he was being detained. And then he was taken directly to jail to await deportation. It was only thanks to this judge in the Southern District of New York in the federal court that she allowed him a few days at least to come out of detention in order to say goodbye to his wife.
That is right, John. We here in New York, we have this accompaniment program for, concerned. We match concerned citizens with people who are checking in to the federal building, the immigration authorities. Because when they check in under this political climate, they may not check out, okay? Nothing has changed. We have to emphasize that it is a continuation of a policy of terror against our communities, our immigrant communities. But as we keep saying, we keep sounding the alarm, because I think we need to really drive the point, if they are coming for us, the immigrants, in the morning, they'll come for you in the afternoon, not even in the evening. This is, this is really quick. It's the culture allows this violence against our communities. And so we are decrying that. We are an interfaith organization. We have coalitions nationally in 25 states. And we have been feeling, we are the front lines, so to speak. We know that the immigrants, what happens to our immigrant communities is going to happen to the rest of our working class, of our people here in America. So we really need to sound the alarm, because our fate it's interwoven with the fate of all others. So we need to sound the alarm that our civil liberties are being corroded, that our democracy is in danger, that we as a nation, we are being shaped into, a monster. And, our identity as Americans is really, really placed on peril.
Juan Carlos, in the last minute and a half or so that we have, I'd like to get your thoughts on where we go from here as a country. I'm sure that you saw the president's State of the Union address last night. I did not find it to be compelling. I did not find it to be bipartisan, as the Washington Post said. I found it to be very angry and very anti-immigrant. So with these four pillars that Donald Trump is talking about, where do we go from here as a country, and how do we deal with immigration? We have about 45 seconds left.
Yeah, we need to dismantle this myth, that the immigration system is broken. It is not broken. It is designed to work this way. By that, it's designed to profit those jails, those prisons. I mean, detentions are on the rise, 147% on the rise, I think. There is a lot of waste of our resources. We need to put back into place the check and balances. It's difficult because we have private corporations profiting. We need to stop that. We need to make visible, the human face of our immigrant brothers and sisters. To make a dent into the system and to make a difference. We need to regularize people.
It is a big job. We're unfortunately going to have to leave it there. Juan Carlos, we were joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition, where Ravi Rugbeer is the executive director. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
An Israeli legal rights group is suing two New Zealanders who reportedly convinced the pop star Lorde to cancel a performance in Israel. This is the first lawsuit filed under a controversial Israeli anti-boycott law. And for the first time in its history, an officer of the Israeli secret police agency, the Shin Bet, is facing a criminal investigation over allegations of torture. We're joined from Washington by Miko Peled. He is the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko also has a new book that's coming out next month called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you guys.
So, Miko, this is the first manifestation of this new anti-boycott law, and it's been filed in Israel. So how does this play out in a country that has freedom of speech and freedom of association? How do you think this is going to play out in the courts?
I think it's a long shot. I don't think this is... they're pulling all the stops. I mean, they are so... And when I say they, I mean the Israeli authorities. They're grasping at straws. I think they're seeing the support for boycott, divestment, and sanctions grow. They're seeing it become more threatening, more effective, more popular. They're seeing the voice of Palestinians around the world becoming louder and louder and more clear and more acceptable. They're seeing, Bernie Sanders meets with Isamro, who's facing 20 charges or something, by Israeli court. And they're just pulling all the stops. I mean, they just, banned the Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee, from entering. They banned Code Pink from entering. I think they're losing their mind in a way. And so now they're suing somebody who told, it's complete nonsense. I mean, they think they can fight this. They think they can make it, less popular. They think they can legislate to stop this. And you can't legislate to stop a movement. So I think they're grasping at straws. I mean, I don't think it's going to be a big deal.
I hear you on that. The southern states, the apartheid states in America did the same thing to Martin Luther King, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and others who engaged in peaceful boycott activities because, frankly, peaceful boycott was about the only avenue open. They were charged with and indicted for and prosecuted for conspiracy to harm business or something like that. But I'm going to read from for our audience from the AP about what's going on. The 2011 law opens the door to civil lawsuits against anyone calling for a boycott against Israel, including of lands it has occupied, if that call could knowingly lead to a boycott. The law, which is part of Israel's fight against the global movement calling for boycotts against the Jewish state, allows for courts to impose damages against defendants. Critics said said that the law would stifle free expression. Then here's the case. The two New Zealanders, Justin Sachs and Nadia Abu Shanab, penned an open letter. This is an open letter to Lorde, the singer, last year, in which they urged her to, quote, take a stand and, quote, join the artistic boycott of Israel, close quote. The New Zealand singer-songwriter replied to a tweet of the letter saying, noted, been speaking with many people about this and considering all options. Thank you for educating me. I am learning all the time, too. And she canceled the show a few days later. And so these people are hauled before the court. It would seem to me, John and Miko, that if anything, this is such a fundamental embarrassment. A state is supposedly founded on the ideas and the principles of democracy. But if you say you should boycott going to their events, if you should boycott as an artist, if you should exercise any fundamental right to speak, to participate or to not participate, then you're subject to not criminal, but civil penalties. It seems like it must have to backfire, but again, only if the BDS movement and its supporters make a big deal out of it, which I guess, Miko, they would and should.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think they would and they should. But I think they're grasping at straws. It's exactly the way you described it. They're pretending to be a democracy, although above democracy, they value their existence as a Jewish state. So being Jewish and having a Jewish majority and maintaining a Jewish majority on all of occupied historic Palestine is the most important thing. And BDS has this reputation of, you know, hating Israel and being against Israel, and we need to do everything we can to stop it. I was at a conference in 2015 or 2016 in Jerusalem where they had this, you know, how do we fight the BDS conference? And they had all the politicians and journalists and Jewish millionaires who contribute to pro-Israeli groups and former Mossad operatives and so on. And one of the things they also had promoters of events. And the promoters were saying that they were trying to downplay what this is about when big names cancel or won't come, and the loss of funds and how they deal with it because they have to invest money in the last minute of the cancellation and so on. Again, I think they're grasping at straws. I think they know that they're fighting, or if they don't know, they should know that they're fighting a losing battle. And I don't think they can fight this. I mean, what are they going to do? Sue her, and it's going to take years, and lawyers are going to deal with it, and more lawyers, and it's just going to drag on forever. I mean, these things are not like you go into a courtroom and it's resolved immediately. You know, so I think it's just maybe some kind of a tactic to try to scare off other artists from doing this in the future. But none of these, the artists that refuse to go and play and perform, do it out of principle. So if they, it's not about money, it's not about the business, it's about principle, it's about refusing to play. It's like they used to refuse to play Sun City in South Africa. This is the new Sun City. This is the refusing to play, you know, apartheid Israel. And again, I think they're hurting themselves also by bringing it up and by stirring it over and over again. It's like the banning of these organizations. It just brings to light how insane they are, how desperate they are, how extreme they are. And this is, again, it's one of those, you know, attempts to stir something up where there's no way that they can win.
And, you know, we've got the same, or not the same, we have a very similar situation here in the United States. Senator Benjamin Cardin of Maryland has sponsored a bill that would outlaw calling for a boycott of Israel here in the United States. The ACLU has come out strongly against this bill, but the bill would actually impose, as it's written right now, a prison sentence of up to 20 years and a $1 million fine if you call for boycotting Israel. Well, it's unconstitutional on its face.
And like Miko said, maybe it's crazy, but nonetheless, it will impact some people. It will cause some trepidation for some people, even people who know that they'll prevail ultimately. Then do we have to get a lawyer? Do we have to spend
exactly.
money on a lawyer? Do we have to devote a bigger and bigger part of our time to legal costs? I mean, I think it's with that calculation in mind. It's sort of a rear guard action to slow down the opposition and divert it.
I think that's exactly right. And we have a minute and a half left. I want to get Miko's take on this, the second part of this story. Miko, in less than a minute now, for the first time in its history, a Shin Bet interrogator is facing a criminal investigation over torture allegations. Can you tell us about this? And do you think this is going to improve the human rights situation at all in Israel?
Well, there's two parts to the answer. If you saw the actual article in Haaretz, the background, the picture that they had at the head of the article had this protest, and the banner behind it in Hebrew says, "A Jew does not torture a Jew." So this is about the Jewish extremist groups that were caught by the Israeli secret police, and perhaps they were tortured in order to get information. That wouldn't surprise me. But the issue is Jews torturing Jews. I don't think this anybody cares over there if they torture Arabs. And the Israeli Supreme Court, you know, made it clear that torture is illegal, but they also left a loophole, a tiny loophole, through which torture can squeak by, which is why they continue to torture. So, you know, they like, again, to present themselves as law-abiding and democracy and human rights and so forth, respecting human rights and so forth. But at the end of the day, they're perfectly fine with torturing Arabs. The issue here, I think, is more, is it okay to torture Jews?
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. We were joined from Washington by Miko Peled. Miko's the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And he has another book coming out next month called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land, Foundation 5. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Bahrain's top court sentenced two people to death and almost 60 more to lengthy prison sentences yesterday on charges of terrorism in a case that the Bahrainis say proves Iranian meddling in their country. The Bahraini prosecutor said the defendants smuggled explosives and weapons into the country after having undergone training in Iran. We're joined from Washington by Mustafa Ahwand. He's the executive director of Shia Rights Watch. Mustafa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Mustafa, the Bahraini government periodically over the last 25 or 30 years arrests groups of people, charges them with terrorism or conspiracy to commit terrorism, and then puts them in prison, usually only to pardon them or commute the sentences later. But this is much larger and the sentence is far more severe than we've seen in the past. What can you tell us?
Well, the Bahraini justice system always were questioned by different people. But right now, with the uprising of Bahrain situation, the justice system have shifted a lot during that time. And they were abusing the law in favor of the government. And if you want to talk about the free, fair trial, you should know that the public hearing, there should be a public hearing, there should be an independent and impartial tribunal for that fair trial. But unfortunately, we don't see that in any legal system in Bahrain.
It seems like the accusations are always against the Iranians. I can tell you, I lived and served in Bahrain for 2 years with the American embassy there. And one of the things that is very clear is that most Bahraini Shia are not Persian. They're what's called Baharna Shia. They're Arab Shia. They don't speak Farsi at home. They speak Arabic at home. They're ethnic Bahrainis. But they're still seen as followers of the Iranian theocrats, the Ayatollahs in Iran. That's unfair. And it leads to human rights violations. As you say, the courts are not public, hearings are not open to the public, and then you end up with these very long sentences and no way to appeal them. One of the other things that the Bahrainis do once they convict people is they'll often revoke their Bahraini citizenship and then expel them to other countries, either Iran or Iraq, in some cases even the UK. Do you see this problem as getting worse, or is this just something that the Bahrainis will continue to do like they've done over the years?
Well, the issue is that Bahrain know that in order for them to get the support and the political support, they have to accuse those citizens from being a, you know, agent of some countries. And right now, because the world is looking toward Iran, the Iran is the best bet for them. Yes, obviously, Bahraini Shia, who are 75% of the population, for them to go to and do practice their religion, they have to travel to either Iraq or Iran for that religious matter. That's why a lot of people travel over there. That doesn't mean that they are going to get trained over there, or they are going there to get any sort of terrorists or any action that can be brought to the to Bahrain. At the same time, you have to see if Bahrain, if Iran really wanted to involve in Bahrain, and if Iran wanted to send a weapon and explosive to Bahrain, it was so easy for them to do that. Why until now we don't see any of those? It's only accusation from Bahrain toward Iran.
That's a good point. For our listeners who don't know anything about Bahrain or where Bahrain is, it's a very small island nation in the Persian Gulf, just off the coast of Saudi Arabia. It's about the same size and same population as Greater Pittsburgh. So we're not talking about a large place. But as you say, it has a very large coastline. And if the Iranians wanted to infiltrate the country or send weapons or send trained terrorists, it would be very easy to do that. I'm also looking, Mustafa, at amnesty.org, which is the Amnesty International website, and it says that since 2011, the Bahraini authorities have revoked the nationality of over 550 people, including at least 150 in 2017. I would venture to say all or nearly all of them are Shia Muslims. It goes on to say that Article 10 of the Bahrain Citizenship Law and its amendments stipulates that nationality can be revoked if a person engages in the military service of a foreign country, if a person helps or engages in the service of an enemy country, or if a person causes harm to state security. But that is not defined, which makes it very, very easy for the government to just expel anyone that they don't like, whose politics they don't like, and to revoke his citizenship.
And before Mustafa jumps in, also just for our audience and listeners to know that in addition to all other things about Bahrain, it's also the anchor for the Fifth Fleet.
That's the most important point, I think. And that's why the Bahrainis get such blind support from the United States, because one of the largest naval presences in the world that the United States has is in Bahrain. Go ahead, Mustafa.
If you want to look at the Article 10 that you are mentioning in 1963, is a damaging security of the states. If we are looking at the uprising until now, we don't see any of those Shia to be have any sorts of terrorist act that damaging the states. We are at the same time, if the foreign, they are working for a foreign country, we can look at the case of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. You know, Bahrain opened the door to Saudi Arabia and the tanks and the army that came to Bahrain to crush the Shia Muslims and the Shia people over there. Shia, since day one, they didn't have anything to do with the religion. It was just getting more rights and more freedom from the government. They didn't care if the government is Sunni or they are the one who are controlling the country, but just having some freedom. But at this, when they saw the government is taking that position of sectarianism and trying to inflame that, they didn't have no other way than telling the people that, okay, we are getting oppressed, we are getting accused of being a Shia so Bahrain can be able to crush us.
You know, I can tell you also that having lived there, as I said a few minutes ago, Shia Muslims are discriminated against in a way that's so insidious that it's just become a part of society. It's become a part of the economy. Shia Muslims are not permitted, for example, to serve in the intelligence services. They're not permitted to serve in the military. They're not permitted to serve in officer positions in the police. They're not even permitted to go to college without permission. You have to get permission from the Minister of Education and the Minister of Interior to go to the University of Bahrain. So this is a daily problem of oppression that they have to live with every day. Mustafa, we have about a minute and a half left. I want to get back to some of these sentences. I'm looking at Al Jazeera today, and it says, of the 60 Bahrainis who were prosecuted at the closed-door hearing, two were sentenced to death, 19 were sentenced to life in prison, 17 were given 15 years. The Bahrainis occasionally do sentence people to death, but almost exclusively when they've killed a policeman, as sometimes happens during rioting. This is different. Nobody's been killed, and there was no terrorist attack. This is a conspiracy case. Do you see this as a trend? Is this getting worse for people in Bahrain?
Oh, definitely. I believe this is just for Bahraini government to test the water to see how they can prosecute and how world would look at Bahrain after this execution. So they could sentence all of them to death, but right now they're trying to see if the international committee will say anything or they even care about the Shias in the country. Then the trend gonna expand and the violation will expand definitely.
That was the voice of Mustafa Ahwand, who joined us from Washington. Mustafa is the executive director of Shia Rights Watch. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Cape Town, South Africa is dangerously close to running out of water. Day zero, as it's being called, is expected in April, and frantic preparations are underway to prepare for this impending ecological crisis. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont, and the co-author of a book called What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. Dr. Magdoff, thanks very much for coming back.
Pleasure to be here.
So this really is a crisis. There was an article in the New York Times yesterday that just paints a picture that couldn't be any worse. The New York Times is comparing this to an event like 9/11, where there will literally be no water. Can you tell us how this happened? Is this climate change? Is it the water table is too low? What's happening in Cape Town?
Well, their water mainly comes from reservoirs, and basically it's about 3 or 4 years that they've had drought conditions, and so there's been very little rainfall, and so the reservoirs are just going down and down and down, The city has done a lot to try to deal with some of the inefficiencies, you know, leakages and pipes and stuff like that. And they've giving fines for people who are using too much water. You're restricted in water use now. And tomorrow, that is February 1st, there's a new restriction goes in. It's even lower. The per person allotment of water is going down in February. So, yeah, I mean the major part of the crisis is that it is caused by very dry conditions, which are projected for southern Africa to become more and more common. That is, to be warmer and drier, and even the wet seasons will be drier than they normally have been before.
Yeah, the New York Times points out that it was not supposed to turn out this way for Cape Town. It says here, the city is known for its strong environmental policies, including its careful management of water in an increasingly dry corner of the world. I think what you just said is exactly the crux of the issue, that it's just getting drier and drier, and there's going to be less and less water as time passes.
Yeah, at one time, Cape Town, and not too long ago, was described as one of the world's top green cities. But, you know, like the old state, no, the old cliche, no man is an island. Well, no city and no country and no region is an island either. We live on this planet. That's a pretty gloomy prospect, Dr. Magduff. What could be done or what will be done if this is protracted for, say, several years? I mean, is this leading to the mass evacuation, the end of Cape Town?
Oh, I don't think so. The day zero, they talk about a day zero, which is projected, at least it's not in the Times story today, but I've seen it previously, is projected to be April 12th, or somewhere around the middle of April, where they will stop water going through the main system into people's homes and businesses as well. And they're talking about setting up, that was in the article today, 200 standpipes, you know, just pipes with faucets on them, and you'll have to go line up for water. But if you figure that the population of Cape Town is 4 million, you know, 200 standpipes means that you've got 20,000 people trying to get water out of each standpipe. You know, you can have these huge lines. It will take a major policing effort or military effort to keep order.
People are talking about the military being called out as a necessity just because there are so many people. There's not going to be any orderly or efficient way in which to dole out this water.
Well, I mean, their system that they have, their plan is to have these 200 pipes, basically with faucets, spread around the city, and those will be the only sources of water. And you have to line up for them. And so, like I said, if you do the math, that's 20,000 people will be relying on each standpipe by on average. And how do you do that? You know, how do you line up 20,000 people, assuming they're going to try to get water every day? I think they are going to probably need the military. They're going to need some way of controlling the situation, just keeping it under control and keeping tempers from flaring. And I think it's going to be quite severe if it continues as it is probably going to.
Climate models show that Cape Town is likely to become even drier still over the next years, rain becoming less and less predictable, the dry seasons being drier, the wet seasons being less wet. I just want to go back because to the question I asked a moment ago when I said, does it mean or could it mean that a place like Cape Town could disappear? I mean, cities and parts of the world have disappeared over the centuries and the millenniums where they become desert. And you said, no, you don't think so. But are you talking in the short, like next year or two, or if we look down 20, 30 years, I mean, is it possible?
Well, there's a lot of water in that region, which is going to agriculture. And so you have the option of saying, okay, we're not, you know, that's high value agriculture, vineyards. Mainly, I'm sure there are other types of agriculture, but that area is known for its vineyards. And one thing the government could do is say, okay, we're going to stop water to agriculture, or we're going to limit their water tremendously. So there's an option there for gaining more water for the cities. Over time, there are other options also. Desalinization, you know, it's right on the ocean. Is certainly possible. It takes a while to build the plants, and that's a lot of investment. But there certainly can be substantial amount of water gained by desalinizing seawater. And then you also have groundwater, which has not been tapped very much. Some of the wealthier people in the city are starting to tap it right now. But the groundwater also needs to be recharged so that you need good rainfall so that the groundwater level doesn't keep going down and down and down as it is in some aquifers around the world. So my point is that there are ways that you can supply a fair amount of water to the city, number one, through taking agricultural water and piping it to the city, and the second, over time, of building desalinization plants. And it may not be as large a city or as it is now, 4 million people, but I wouldn't be surprised they could keep that going for quite a while. Eventually, I don't know. I mean, if it turns into a complete, you know, desert type area, which I don't think that's projected, then desalinization would be the only source, really.
Dr. Magdoff, if I had come into this conversation in the middle and listened to this discussion about a lack of water, water being used for agriculture, especially high-end agriculture like vineyards, I would think that we were talking about Los Angeles. Because really, Los Angeles is going through, it has gone through the last few years, just about the same kind of thing. Can you foresee a crisis of this kind of proportion hitting Los Angeles?
Well, all of California was, in drought for basically 4 years, a severe drought. And so, I mean, you had major problems. You had some irrigation was shut down because of it. And you had farmers who were not able to plant. The workers who worked there were not able to get jobs. And so it had a severe effect on the economy of California, mainly, you know, Central and Southern California, where it's drier than in the northern part of the state. So it's not just Los Angeles. But Los Angeles also gets water, and California gets water, pumped from outside of California into the state. So there's water pumped in from other states that help, you know, but they still rely tremendously on natural rainfall that falls within California boundaries. So it was quite severe. You weren't able to, wash your car. You weren't able to water the grass. And as I mentioned, there were a number of farms, farming areas that were told they could not irrigate and because the water was needed for, human consumption, direct human consumption. So it was pretty severe. If it had gone on for another year or two, who knows?
We'll have to leave that as the last word. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We were joined from Burlington, Vermont by Dr. Fred Magdoff, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont and co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Saudi Arabia has moved the remaining 56 princes it had been holding at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh on corruption charges to secure private palaces and, in some cases, to actual prisons. Other princes have secured their own release by turning over to the government more than $106 billion that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman says was made through corrupt practices. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Ali, I think that many of us, me included, didn't think this was a serious thing. I thought this was a temporary fight between individual princes and it would go away after a while. But Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been very serious about keeping his cousins locked up, even though it was in the Ritz-Carlton, until they paid this money. And now it's no longer the Ritz-Carlton. We know from the press that that Prince Turki bin Abdullah, the son of former King Abdullah, has been sent to a private palace, but then had it surrounded by barbed wire, and other more minor princes are going to prison. So what's happening in Riyadh?
What's happening in Riyadh, you have a new leadership that is represented by Mohammed bin Salman, who sees himself as the only power in the country, and he does not like competition. He doesn't like to be given advice on how he runs the country. And he believes that this money in the hand of his cousin poses a threat to him and his authority. And at the same time, it's an opportunity for him to gain greater power by marginalizing these figures and using that money to advance his own interests and plans to the country. So he has been unchallenged, clearly without any challenge from any part of the ruling family. And in fact, he has received support, open support from the United States, from the president, President Trump, and a tacit support from other governments in Europe, especially the United Kingdom and other governments who have not criticized this move to take over this $100 billion plus.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because you've made a very important point here. There is literally no one in the kingdom now that can challenge Mohammed bin Salman for primacy. Mohammed bin Nayef, who's the former crown prince and the son of another former crown prince, Nayef bin Abdulaziz, is no longer in the picture. And indeed, he appears to be still under house arrest. Without Mohammed bin Nayef, it seems to me that there is nobody that can challenge Mohammed bin Salman. Do you think that's the case? And if so, was that the original goal with these arrests?
I believe so. In the trajectory of Mohammed bin Salman, I've written about that maybe 3 years ago in a private discussion with the American ambassadors and specialists, that Mohammed bin Salman, before he even became the defense minister, when he was an advisor with his father, he clearly exhibited drive for primacy and leadership. He is now the unchallenged and the strongest leader in Saudi history. He's the strongest and most influential Saudi leader ever, even greater in influence than the founder of the country, his grandfather, King Abdulaziz, who people compared him to. And Abdulaziz is a legend, really, in spite of anything you can say about him and his brutality. So there is no part or grouping within the ruling family that has the capacity to challenge, let alone remove Mohammed bin Salman from his position. All the economic, political, security, and military positions are in one hand. That is Mohammed bin Salman. The power in Saudi Arabia now is concentrated in his person, and no one, including cousins or uncles, have the capacity, and I don't think they have the gumption to oppose him. And that has been clear in the past year. No one came out speaking against him, including those he toppled with the swiftly. We, as analysts and watchers, we saw this coming, but Mohammed bin Nayef didn't do anything. Mohammed bin Nayef, that the United States government gave access and promoted as the king, that the United States saw him as their ally, as the Wilson Center says Washington Prince in Riyadh, or the Brookings CIA operator wrote about him. He's the epitome of counterterrorism. He is now under house arrest and able to leave his house. So this shows you that you cannot trust the American administration to back you and support you. And it shows that Mohammed bin Salman, really, his shirk, maybe really rush and desire for power, has been able to do it without much cost to himself.
Ali, in the West, much is made of the fact, or the description of the crown prince as a reformer, cultural norms that have been so restrictive. Here we have certainly a power grab, the elimination of rivals for power. He's pursuing an aggressive, I would say, a policy in Yemen that's nothing short of war crimes and crimes against humanity. But just because you're there, I mean, not there, you're here, you're in Washington, D.C., but you're the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Talk about the issue of reform, of social reform within the kingdom.
Look, the United States and the intelligentsia, the media, the newspapers, and the government with PR agencies have called every Saudi a leader, a reformer, especially when they arrived to power. They called King Abdullah the same thing. They called King Fahd, King Faisal, King Saud since 1950s. And all of these leaders were not reformers. So this is really a broken record we hear every time a new leader of Saudi Arabia emerges. They are not. He's not a reformer. Certain things that are going to change the country, these are not reforms. These are necessities of life. If Mohammed bin Salman is a reformer, Fidel Castro is a saint because, you know, Fidel, in the parliament in Cuba, 45-48% of the parliament are women. And women rights there are wonderful, but it doesn't take away the criticism of being, you know, a leader who ruled for 50 years. Same thing in Saudi Arabia. The calling reformers is trying to legitimize a person, an autocrat who rules without allowing for dissent. I believe the United States has empowered Saudi leaders to stay in power for its own interest, and in order to justify these policies, both the United States and the UK must say, "Oh, this guy's a reformer. He's going to allow women to drive." Yes, he's going to allow women to drive, but these women, at the same time, cannot get a passport unless their male master, okays it, and they cannot get married, and they still are basically. Imagine this: you know, slaves were allowed to drive, and that's called the reform. You know, women still are really, for practicality, are slaves of their male guardians, and slave driving does not change the fact that they are slaves.
Ali, tell us what this consolidation of power in the hands of Mohammed bin Salman does to the war in Yemen. We have about a minute and a half left.
Well, the war in Yemen continues, and we see, you know, a new stage in the Saudi UAE war there, trying to basically break the country into fighting factions. And what happened in Aden a few days ago, of the southern separatists taking over the so-called legitimate government of Yemen, the palace and so on. So that was designed by the Saudis, the UAE, to break the Yemeni people into different states and breaking Yemen not only into two states, but maybe more. And that has been expressed by Saudi operatives that that's the best outcome for the Saudi and UAE policies. Weakening Yemen and dividing Yemen to pieces ensures that Yemen cannot pose a challenge both to the Saudi and the UAE powers in the region. And UAE has already annexed part of the Yemen territory, especially the island of Socotra and Neon. So you are really looking at a very clear case of committing crime and breaking down a population, a united country, into several parts, so you can take advantage of its position, ports, and national resources.
Brian, there's really very little in the way of good news coming out of this story. It's certainly something that bears watching, and we will watch it. We were joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking that page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.